Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 26th, 2005. Tonight's forum, Holden's Energy Future, a forum about alternative energy at Holden, past, present, and future. Let's listen in.
Energy Future is the title of the forum. Pretty self-explanatory, I think. We're here tonight to talk about the future of Holden. There's also going to be a lot of history this weekend and reminiscing and storytelling, but tonight we want to look ahead and talk about how the world is changing and how Holden is going to have to change along with it if we want to keep living up here. So you can kind of think of it as a brainstorming session, I would say, just to feel free to throw out ideas. We're probably not going to want to try to get into too great a detail tonight as far as, you know, arguing back and forth about the viability of each and every idea that comes up, but just know that it's being taped and that we will have that available to us to go back and look at everyone's ideas and make plans for the village. And that will be work that the SciTech committee does and that Holden leadership and operations staff do throughout the years to keep this place running. That's about all I have to say by way of introduction. I think Rick wanted to show a few pictures.
To show a few things from an historical perspective, a few shots out of the museum collection. Part of thinking ahead to energy options is thinking back to what's been done already. There has been a fair amount of experimentation, so I thought I would give a few examples of Holden's energy history and then some time for Holden's energy future. So we know how important energy is to us here. And it's been one of the fundamental issues for the village absolutely since day one. Holden has been dealing with questions of how to provide enough energy for operating this place for literally since the first volunteers came in. It's a picture that's a little out of focus, so it's probably sharp enough. The first volunteers came in 1961 to start cleaning up the old ghost town, and they had nothing but wood power, at least when they got started. Here are some clothes washing in tubs on top of an outdoor fire pit fireplace. That's how meals were cooked at first, and that's all they had to work with. Nothing else was much functioning when they first got here. Eventually they got a little portable generator, the little blue generator here, so now they're powering some of the clothes wringer washers here with that little generator. And then in 61 was also when diesel generators were brought in. They were, as I understand, purchased in Alaska as used machines, and so brought in here on the barge. Lifted off the barge onto the 61 truck and brought up the hill and slid into place on the pad, a concrete pad, and then the building was constructed around those generators, and that was the beginning of Holden's power system. Those were the years when the power went off at 10 o'clock. These diesels were turned off. Mark, I think this is one of your slides.
I still have the hard hat and the boots, but nothing else. Everything else shrank.
Maybe you could describe this project in a
very brief. Right below the gargoyle recycling, where the school buses are full of cardboard and so on there, the mining company left that 15,000-gallon tank, and the village decided they wanted it by the diesel plant. You just saw the diesel generator. So we stored it on that truck and trailer.
Oh my goodness.
We had to wait until we bought 28-foot pieces of chain to go from the truck up over the tank and back in.
Oh, wow. That was hardy helping.
It's a party Christmas on the right, far right there, right there, right there.
How old are you then, Mark?
Ooh.
I was like
23, probably.
And of course, tomorrow we'll talk about the hydro plant and the associated facility, so we won't spend much time on that tonight, but that came online in in the mid-1960s. And then, as I say, the Science and Technology Committee and the village have been involved in a variety of energy experiments. One that is still visible and, although not still functional, is the water wheel near the river sauna. And that was constructed as an experiment to generate electrical power. It didn't generate too much, if I understand. The way that Gertrude described it was about enough to power a coffee pot. One of the other famous experiments was the Great Jerusalem Artichoke Experiment, trying to grow Jerusalem artichokes on the tailings, in part to help revegetate the tailings, but also the idea was not to eat the artichokes, but to use them to distill the alcohol fuel supplement in the village. So, unfortunately, the distilling process, as I understand it, didn't work very well.
Still
never
power.
Great. Yeah. There have been a number of experiments with solar energy in various forms. Here, a solar hot water heating system for the river sauna. Not to heat the plunge pool, but to heat the water for the showers. Of course, 1980, one of the big projects was the Koinonia Edition, and part of the project was to try and use passive solar energy, so windows on the south side and a solar greenhouse on the south side, recognizing the fact that deep in the wintertime there isn't much solar energy available. But perhaps in the late autumn and spring, when power was still a little bit low, that there would be enough sunlight to take advantage of that. Unfortunately, that system didn't work as hoped either. So now the solar greenhouse on the bottom has been converted to the pot shop. The windows are still there along the south side, and they get sometimes uncomfortably hot in the summertime, but those will come out in the remodel process. So just a shot. And same sort of technology was used when the B&B building was constructed down lake, although then it was a project called Tekoa, intended as an outside community for Holden. And so the greenhouse facility was built there to try and provide both solar heating and to grow some food. When the Koinonia Edition was in place, the idea was to have a kitchen and dining room in what today is the Creekside Room and the Reading Room. That, for a while, became the wintertime dining room and kitchen, again, to save energy and to not have to heat and open the hotel during the wintertime. So that was part of the strategy. Of course, wood has always been important here at Holden. This was the fireside room when it was first constructed with the hood in place, and the fires were beautiful, but the energy effects were not very beautiful. Most of the heat went right up that chimney. Most of the heat of the room went right up that chimney.
It was a good radiator, though.
What?
It was a pretty good radiator, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Especially in the 1980s, mid to late 1980s, the village started to move much more toward the use of wood, trying to move away from fossil fuels into a renewable energy source. And even more of the wintertime heating was done with wood than before, and that was about the time that the Essex system was built, a wood-fired boiler that heats the lower chalets, so you have a common boiler system for all those lower chalets. Some other efforts at wood use. The problems that developed were in part pollution problems. When you're burning that much smoke, especially was a problem in the wintertime. One of the ways the village tried to address that was to begin splitting the wood farther ahead of time, a year ahead of time, 2 years ahead of time if possible, to give it more time to dry, to reduce the smoke. But there were concerns about how much staff power and risk there was cutting wood, splitting wood. Took a lot of staff time during the summer. So into the 90s, the village began to move away from a total commitment to wood. Wood is still very important in the village energy scene. But there was a recognition that some of the problems, some of the limitations of wood, perhaps we should look at some other types of energy systems. One of the things that's been done is retrofitting buildings to improve insulation, especially one of the early examples was the Chalet 7 project. As that chalet was remodeled, it was also very much improved in terms of windows and insulation levels. And now it's a chalet heated with diesel oil, but because the insulation is so good, the use of that fossil fuel is much less than it would have been otherwise. And so there was this recognition that perhaps using fossil fuels and better insulated buildings would be a way to reduce some of the risk of wood burning, some of the pollution problems of wood burning, and still be able to provide some of Holden's energy needs. This was from a couple winters ago, just remodeling Lodge 4. The pile there is the sawdust insulation that was up in the attics of many of these buildings. So part of retrofitting buildings was to get rid of the dangerous insulation and replace that with safer and more effective insulation, although Lodge 4 didn't get re-insulated, did it? It's a summer building, but Lodge 1 and 6 had the same kind of sawdust insulation in them when they were remodeled. Staff knitting parties, that's another way to get through a cold winter is to knit warm clothes. So if you're cutting down on energy use, maybe you've got to find some other ways to keep warm. And part of the experimentation through the years has been with transportation systems as well. That's another big energy consumption for the village. I just tossed in this shot of the old Holden boat. So buses and boats and other vehicles are also some of the questions we ought to deal with a little bit in our energy questions. Of course, we always rely on the power of prayer. So we continue to do that, and that's probably what most gets this village through as much as any other kind of power source. So, like I said, just a few shots to get the juices flowing a little bit.
Thank you, Rick. You kind of made me look like a liar because I said we were going to talk about the future, but now we really will talk about the future.
We know where we've been, so.
Or at least the present. We're going to have Casey Kula, who just took some pictures today of the glacier up in Copper Basin. He's going to show us some pictures and talk about his graduate research. Here in the valley, the Copper Basin, and how our water supply will likely change.
Did I just turn off the
projector?
No, you put cap on it.
Rick was messing around, so I swear I was on time. Okay, I don't need a mouse.
Put the cap on the projector.
Exactly. You don't want to look at this. I've talked amongst yourselves.
Does anyone have questions for Rick while we're waiting? Any of those old projects? Some of you were probably here for some of those.
You know, one of the projects that sort of was on energy was removing all the old storage tanks for all the old diesel fuel. I mean, which brings in a whole other aspect of the impact of one of those types of energy sources is the pollution.
And not just removing the tanks, but all the soil that the oil had leaked into over the years. ₹2,500 cubic yards of contaminated soil.
Another project that wasn't pictured was the solar water heater on the roof of Agape to preheat water for the laundry, but the trouble was that it wouldn't be able to survive the winter, and it was not practical to put it up every summer and take it down when you didn't need it and take it down every winter when it would have been helpful if there were any sunshine. So I understand that the outdoor sauna, that pool out in front of the outdoor sauna, was a fish experiment. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear about that. They tried to use that for commercial fish growing or for the village itself?
For the village. They were raising trout in there. And we're having reasonable success until some contaminated water got in there.
Yeah.
And all the fish went belly up kind of at the same moment. And so there was one fish dinner from the fish. That was about it.
You know, though, that's something, though, where Holden failed at that, but Meredith Olson, who took that over,
that was her project,
has had tremendous success in East Africa with fish culture. It's been a phenomenal success over the last two decades. So Holden screwed up, but she learned from it. And the seeds were planted and the fish became fertilizer.
And we got the swimming pool now, too. Well, I think we had more than one fish dinner out of that.
Yeah, I think there were more than one fish dinner. The problem was the fish weren't very good. That was the big problem. So when they went belly up, I think there was a sigh of relief.
The fact that they didn't contaminate water.
No, not those. It had to do with what they were fed.
Ponds was dug for the sauna.
Yeah.
She had to modify it the best she could to eat the fish. It wasn't the way she would have designed it.
Yeah, the pond itself, in terms of a fish culture pond, has a little bit to be desired.
Right.
She was making it. Was adapted.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm ready.
All right. Oh.
Very exciting. Hey, Asa, can you come up here again? Dear, I'm not working.
Mine are poles
in the water. Yeah. Okay. So, this last winter, there was a big rainstorm in the middle of January. The temperature up at Lyman Lake was 68 degrees, was the high, on I think January 21st. And that initiated essentially the snow melt for the year. On Copper Creek, from 1972 to 2004, the day at which the creek starts to rise from its winter low has gotten earlier and earlier in this season. It's gone from approximately water year day 194 to water year day 177, which represents almost 2 weeks earlier that the creek is starting to rise. And not only is the winter snowmelt starting, or the spring snowmelt starting earlier, the volume of the water is also earlier. As you can see, from 1972 to 2004, it's a fairly impressive scene, even though it's all over the place.
When does the water year begin?
The water year begins October 1st. We get our water, obviously, from the glacier up in the in Copper Basin. It's actually called Ferno Glacier. And Ferno Glacier, if this picture was a little bit better, you could see where the snow, where the ice is actually ablated. There's been area lost in the ice just over this past summer. There's places where it's wet, and it's very clear that there was ice there earlier in the season, and there isn't now. This is this afternoon.
Wow.
Or actually, this was like 6:20 this evening. This is the remnant of part of the Ferno Glacier. There's a little ridge you can see in the foreground, a little knoll. Ferno Glacier used to be one piece on either side of that really big ridge, and was connected through that knoll. And now there's very little left of the north-facing piece, which you can kind of see from the top of Shallot Hill. And you can definitely see as you first pop into Copper Basin when hiking there.
Is this the one with the moraine kind of at the bottom?
Yeah, yes, exactly. You can kind of see it in the foreground. There's two big piles. And perhaps the reason why is that the heating degrees at Holden, heating degree days at Holden have increased over the past 30 years. Actually, over the past 40 years. The heating degree days are how many degrees over 65 are there a total in a year. And of late, it's been increasing quite a bit. So my research is actually not anything related to Holden's snowmelt, but it's kind of related. So this is some of my data. It's perhaps a time to get things talked about earlier winters, an earlier spring, more power in the spring, as we saw this last spring, and perhaps a milder winter. In addition, some very dry summers are perhaps in store for us, and very warm summers, and perhaps as well no glacier to back us up right about now. So it's potentially that the only water that would be going through the hydro would be groundwater, and there's not a lot of that around here right now. So something to keep in mind for the future, even though this too is the past.
I don't know, it's pretty current.
can you go back to the first picture with the glacier?
Yeah.
Maybe if we leave that up there as a stimulant for some of our discussion.
That might work.
Those of you that weren't at the science and tech meeting this afternoon maybe didn't hear that about a week ago we started turning down the needle valve at the hydroelectric plant, which means that we're using all the water that's available. And every day now we'll have a little bit less electricity. And that's a common phenomenon every year, but it usually happens in October. And now it's happening in August this year. And on the other end, as Casey mentioned, we had a warm January, and that's when the spring melt was. And we, from mid-January on, had hydroelectric power for all of our energy needs in the village. So we gained it on the one side and lost and are losing it on the other side, which matches exactly the graph that was shown to us in a teaching session on global warming this summer of earlier spring melt and lower summer, late summer flows. So this year seems to be a little snapshot of what possibly would be more common in the future.
Snow has gone 2 weeks, two months early at Lyman Lake than the 30-year average, which is kind of interesting.
And record low flows are being recorded at the Stehekin River, for example, and others that are being gauged and monitored.
What snowfall, how much snowfall did you get this winter?
So 140, was it? Does anyone remember the exact number?
I think it got over 100.
150.
And perhaps an alternative for us is to have lots of power in the wintertime with the hydro and have solar panels for power in the summer, in the late summer.
This winter, we didn't burn any diesel fuel or burn any firewood. So we benefited greatly by this year. Of course, we may be paying for it now, this fall.
But still, you might even end up breaking even.
Maybe. We hope that we won't have to start burning firewood when it's still fire season, though.
What was the cold temperature two nights ago?
About
42. 42? I thought I saw 40 on the board.
Well, that's at my house.
Okay.
But you did say that when you went out through Copper Basin on Wednesday that up in the basin itself early in the morning there was ice on the groundwater.
It wasn't even that early. That was about 9:30 and it was still ice.
The overnight freezing level was down below 6,000 feet.
I think it's interesting to think about what Wayne just said is as this shift in weather occurs, it means perhaps our paradigms need to shift in terms of what didn't work in the past may begin to work differently now. The slides showing the solar panels that really were trying to be used at the wrong time of year maybe become something to consider as these things shift around.
I thought you meant artichokes.
I was going to let Wayne get to that.
So in the winter months, not this year, but other winter months, one of the things which has been very important is sort of education about conservation. And the winter community is very aware of that. When the student community comes in for January, that's a big part of their education. There hasn't been education about conservation of energy in the summer because it hasn't been an issue. I mean, everybody can bring a hairdryer who wants to bring a hairdryer as opposed to J-term when they're all told not to bring one. And so it seems to me there's also another role that needs to be taken on, which is thinking about how to, if these changes are persistent, of how to work sort of the piece of changing some behaviors. I mean, clearly you're going to have to use vast amounts of energy for the kitchen and the dish pit and all that if you have 450 people in the village, but do people have to take showers that are as long as they are, as frequent as they are, you know, various things like that.
But instead of like hunger awareness, we had to kill the power once a week or something just for people to remember what it's all about.
Well, if we start having electrical shortages in the summer, then the lessons learned from winter we can apply to summer. I mean, we know how to do it. We just haven't ever needed to in the summertime. So that would be a challenge. In fact, one of the things that was rather annoying in January is when the power came up, we had just gotten through this annual ritual of convincing the village that we had to have to share power and conserve. And suddenly we were heating the village center, and all of our education, we didn't have a good object lesson to point to. But we know how to do that, and we can do it in the summer as well.
There's also five times, if my math is right, there's five times as many people in the summer currently as in the winter, you know, on a given day, approximately. So potentially that could be shifted. We could become a winter retreat center, which would probably put a damper in the books, the accounting. But
I'm just curious what the big energy uses are. I get the impression the winter uses more energy, or is it just that the hydro is frozen and you don't get hydro, or what are the uses of energy and when do you need it and for what?
It's both. In the winter, as the creek flow drops or generating capacity drops,
And we're on unit one in the summer, we have 300 kilowatts available. 5 winters ago, for about 6 weeks, we had 31 kilowatts. So we have to supplement that with wood or fuel oil. The other thing is, right now, we're not heating any buildings. And that's a very significant load. Actually, our peak demand, though, occurs in May and June and in the fall, September, October, because the population is so high and there are just so many people here. The kitchen uses a lot, you're cooking a lot more, so it's using more and more people are taking showers. And at that time of year, it's cool enough that the heating systems are running in a lot of the buildings. So you have both the high population and heating demand.
So long as the creek is running, then your big demand is for winter. Assuming the creek runs, they should flow.
Well, yeah, the flow typically, as Christopher said, starts dropping in October, which means our generating capacity drops and usually coincides with about the time the village population drops. It's gotten earlier each of the last 3 years, and here we are in August. We're losing power already, and in September, October, we have some very big events coming in the village.
Our per capita use is higher in the winter with space heating. In the summer, our total use is higher because it's more people.
How many breakdowns do you have in terms of submetering on power? Different is each building separately metered?
Are they metered?
Yeah.
No, we don't meter, we don't have any meters in the village at all. And so we just meter the entire output of the hydro. We've discussed installing meters to give us some more information, but there aren't any currently installed. Which was always a nice thing. People are used to meter power in here. There was no meters. It was all essentially free. You either use it or lose it.
You get serious about conservation, though. It's kind of a general rule in process improvement, but if you don't measure it, nothing happens. So ultimately, I think you will want to be metering more.
In the winter time, even though it's not metered, you know, we're extremely conscious of how much there is and how it gets used and allocated. And, you know, it's almost a full-time job for somebody to allocate that power for different needs, different times of the day.
When you say allocate, how do they do the allocating?
Well, a lot of it's done by a computer program now, but it's still some of it's done by hand, and it used to all be done by hand. Turning off and on breakers is the old way. And now the computer program turns off and on contactors, and according to set priorities of the computer. During the time that we're washing dishes, then the priority is there. In the middle of the night, when people are sleeping, the priority is making hot water for the next day. And during the workday, the priority is towards coffee and power tools.
During one of the board meetings early in the spring, I think it was 3 years ago, maybe four, when I was up here on staff, the automatic switch on the boiler over here in Lodge 4 failed. So I became the boiler switch, and I would go out and turn the boiler off, the water heater off at 10 o'clock at night, and then I'd go back down at 4 in the morning and turn it back on again so that it didn't overheat during the night. But that was the only way we could guarantee that the board had hot water for their showers the next morning.
You know, one of the
maybe they shouldn't have.
Energy future. Energy future questions is the demand. What kind of prediction can we make about demand when the cleanup gets underway? And whether or not that, how big a role does that play in the solutions that the village needs to work with? And I don't know if that's something that we can add some information to help folks offer some ideas.
Not all of you know, but within the next year or two, we think, the big mine cleanup will begin, and the tailings in the mine and so forth will be remediated, and the pollution that's being contributed to Railroad Creek will be dealt with. And as part of that ongoing cleanup, there'll be a water filtration plant of some kind that will have some kind of energy use forever associated with it. And right now, it looks like it'll be somewhere between 30 and 100 kilowatts. It's not really decided yet. And that power will need to be provided for, and the village can't do it. If we're down to 31 kilowatts, which is not so unusual in the wintertime, then that would be entirely needed by the water filtration plant. So there will be other generating capacity in the valley by the mining company. And we have an agreement in principle with the mining company to share power, to have an intertie, where we would potentially provide power in the summer or during times we have excess power, and they would in turn pay us back that same power to their generating facility during the times that we have a shortage. But there will be another power plant, very likely, in this valley sometime soon. It'll be much smaller than ours, and it probably won't be hydro, although that's not certain either. We wish it would be another hydro plant, but the capital costs for hydro are very expensive, and the payback is fairly long.
Is the flow of the water out of the mine at all comparable to the flow of the water in Copper Basin?
No.
Well, the head is much less.
Well, I mean in terms of the volume of water.
No, the volume of water is substantially smaller than what's in Copper Creek.
But I mean, does it vary? The same way Copper Creek does, so that
yes.
So you need less power than presumably in Copper Creek.
Well, what they're planning on doing is putting a bulkhead in the mine, so that water will be backed up inside the mine, so they'll even out the seasonal flows, so they'll essentially have a steady flow out of the portal year round, and that way they can build a much smaller water treatment plant than they would otherwise have to.
They back it up enough to put a generator.
They probably would use that water pressure in some way, but it's not very much capacity.
So what you just described opens the door to talk about whether or not there's a shift in a power approach for the village too. I mean, it probably has to be is a real consideration whether or not hydro becomes a minor source as opposed to the major source.
You mean compared to the other generating plant that would be built?
Well, I suppose one of the things that occurs to me is that if there is a partnership going some fuel type of generators put in, whether or not it is sized so that it can generate power for the whole village, while it's also generating power for the water treatment plant, since it has to be run 12 months out of the year. And if that becomes a possibility, what kind of things do we think about? What kind of fuels, what kind of location, what does it do to the ambient noise in the valley? Just the things that we have to imagine, we have to deal with if that becomes the case.
So is there any sense of what they are looking at as the source of power?
They're proposing a diesel fuel power plant, at least initially. Since they're talking about hundreds of years of operation, there'll probably be different generations of equipment. And it would be owned and operated by the mining company, and it wouldn't be located necessarily in the village either. And it probably wouldn't be sized large enough to power the entire village. And it probably wouldn't run year-round. The theory is that it would run half the year, during the half that we can't supply it, as has been the historical experience, but that may be changing, or at least it may be shifting to a different time of the year, which doesn't really impact that agreement. But there's a lot of unknowns in that whole scenario. It's the biggest one being the exact power needs of the treatment plant, because that has not been agreed upon about what it needs to
you'd like yet.
Have they determined the process that they're going to use for treating?
No. No, they're still arguing over that between a more high power need mechanized treatment plant and a more passive lagoon type system. So the power needs for those two, there's a fairly widespread there. Some of you might have some experience with alternative energy, either in your professional life or just down lake on your own. If you have some thoughts or ideas that you think might be helpful to the village, we'd love to hear about them.
So how many of the winter buildings used during the winter are insulated?
All the ones that we use are insulated in the winter.
Some better than others.
Some better than others. Some quite a bit better than others. We've remodeled quite a few buildings. Lodge 6, Lodge 1, Agape, the hotel, Chalet 7, Chalet 2 is new, and this building will be remodeled this winter. And all of those have, you know, extensive insulation in them.
Geothermal heat source or groundwater? That's kind of thing, another question for around here.
It's not something that has been determined that exists as any kind of thermal heat source. Does anyone know anything about any?
The closest area I'm aware of in the work that I've done in the past is down in the Yakima Valley. It's about the closest point where there's geothermal of any large substance. There's so much rock here that the sources aren't there. And if they are, you'd have to go, I think you'd have to drill quite deep through a lot of rock.
Kennedy Hot Springs.
But geothermal doesn't have to be a particularly high source of heat. I mean, that term is getting used more and more also to refer to sort of heat pump systems. Just looking at that differential between groundwater and air temperature.
But it takes energy to run the heat pump.
Sure.
Yeah. But you get more bang for the buck. What we've really concentrated on is energy efficiency, because we had so much to gain there, because it was, you know, so poor originally in the mining days. So we've gained a huge amount of efficiency there. That and our load control systems to use the hydro resource that we have, you know, stretches a lot further than it ever has.
How far do you think we have to go still on energy efficiency?
I don't think there's ever an end to it.
Right.
And once we remodel the last building, we'll turn around and start remodeling the first one again, because the standards will be higher and the technology will be better. In fact, we're doing that. You know, Koinonia has been remodeled. This is not original, and it does have some insulation in it. So those chalets are probably the poorest insulated buildings right now. The chalet that I live in has insulation that's been added to the attic, but there's still no insulation in the walls, and it's very poorly air sealed. And the chalet I live in now uses approximately 5 times the firewood as the same size house that we own in Idaho. So there's a lot to gain there in those smaller buildings, and we'll get to those. But you know, we've been more concentrating on the bigger users, like Koinonia now.
Your chalet is not the one that had been remodeled, or it is?
It's not been remodeled. It was painted.
The difference in usage of firewood between yours and the one that's been remodeled is that?
That one doesn't use firewood.
Oh, it doesn't use firewood, so it's hard to compare apples and oranges.
Right, and Rick mentioned that it's heated with diesel oil, and that's true, how it can be. But most years it's 100% electricity that heats it. You know, last year certainly was. And it uses such a small amount of electricity that generally that one can be staying electric year round.
Would someone comment on the biodiesel experiment? Just that's intriguing and interesting, and that hasn't come up yet.
Some of you have noticed that we have one bus that's running on 30% biodiesel right now. And that's a pilot project we just started this summer with the encouragement of the Science and Technology Committee. And if that pilot project goes well, and it has been, we will expand that to the whole fleet and to the rest of our diesel needs. We don't have a source right now for large volumes of biodiesel, but we think that will be changing soon. Right now we get it in 55-gallon barrels that gets delivered to the barge company, and we mix that with regular diesel.
So have you talked about having a summer bus that would be a B100?
Yes, yes, and I think that's one of the things that we're talking about. We're getting through the sort of first hurdle right now, is to get the fuel and to mix it and to see how that operates with the one bus, and then we'll be expanding that probably to B20 year round, and then possibly B100 on at least a vehicle, and see how that works. But we do need a better source before we can expand it that far. And we do need to put in another tank, which we don't have right now. But we've started, and it's run really well. We haven't had any problems with the vehicle, and it's gone well. Those, if some of you rode up, and did any of you ride in the bus that runs in biodiesel?
Yeah.
So do you notice any difference? You all got here.
It's really
works.
Yeah,
it's bumpy.
Yeah, which I think is your fault.
Can generators and heating systems run on biodiesel too?
Sure.
The generator essentially is just another big diesel engine, so that shouldn't be an issue. It's an older, our particular diesel generators are old enough that it probably is going to need some fuel system work. But the heating systems, John, can you comment on that?
Well, in Germany and on North Rhine-Westphalia, I saw generation and heat generation done with rapeseed oil, and they weren't having any problem at all. It was a small scale, but it was like 50 houses. And I really think that a standing system's good, especially like when you see like gasification and or biodiesel, because there are potentials to use the heat as well, whereas in a vehicle, usually you lose your heat, so you can use both.
But as far as in a fuel oil boiler.
Exactly, no problem.
The problem there would be winter temperature.
And you might need to have tank heating systems installed, and relatively simple. What I can tell.
What temperature is B100 need to stay at in order to?
Well, B100, those more sensitive ones were the less pure forms of biodiesel. So if you do any kind of recycling or whatever, then it's critical. So you'll see like biodiesel cars, they call them oil burners, where because it's so impure that they have to heat the oil up to high temperature to get it to work. But if the purer sources, you pretty much have to get it to be like a relatively, I don't remember the exact numbers, but a relatively room temperature would do it, and summer room temperature, like 60 degrees probably cover it. But with a vehicle one, a tank warming system, they have relatively cheap systems. And what I saw in North Rhine-Westphalia with their rapeseed, they had it inside a building and there was a warming system, but I could get stats for you, so I could look into it. But there's a lot of potential with biofuels. What I saw from India, I met some folks in Germany who were doing gasification systems that were really simple. And it seems like here with the glaciers melting, you're going to have more wood growing. Would that be true there? As far as more? Maybe, yeah. But as far as gasification, you have less ice, you have more wood potential, I think. And also the fact that it could even out things, having your own biofuel, and you can run a school bus on gasification wood. I have known some folks who've done that for years. It's relatively simple. And then you get to heat your bus at the same time, because you have essentially a wood stove in the bus, producing also the gas that runs the bus. So you get two things at once, a nice warm bus and your own fuel, rather than relying on outside sources. Because like in Seattle, the demand for biodiesel has gone through the roof, and the supply is starting to go up, but I don't know how that relation is going to work, if the demand's going to outstrip the supply or what. So potentially with something like wood, you wouldn't have that issue. You can use folks use pine cones ground up that they feed in to a fire there. So there's all potential for all kinds of waste wood to be used in that way too. And then again, you can purify it by filtering it, the gas, and cut down on your emissions, your greenhouse emissions that way too.
Yeah, I was just gonna ask, what are the CO2 emissions on a gasification system?
Well, CO2, of course, reabsorbs into the system. It's the CO that doesn't, but.
Reabsorbs where?
Into the plants. It's part of the life cycle, so.
but it's not.
It definitely is. It's a zero, it's fossil fuels, you have that potential that, because that's been stored there for a long time, but if you think about it, when you burn an organic material, it returns easier into the system there. It's more of a zero sum. The amount that goes in goes back, so it's a.
But it's no, that's it's the opposite.
Yeah.
It's the amount that goes out and goes in.
Well, okay, thanks.
So it's not technically a zero sum system if you're cutting more wood than is being the carbon's being fixed.
So there are at least advantages to, let's say, gasification rather than just if you already burn wood for heating. And how much do you burn a year? I mean, you can actually gain a lot of energy from what you're already using and clean it up. So if you're already burning something, you're not planning on cutting it out. Have you just thought about giving up wood? So that's probably not a question. You already know that you have to rely somewhat on wood, so might as well get all you can out of it and pollute less. So that's something that could be studied there. Have you studied gasification potentials here?
No.
It's relatively simple technology too. And again, once you have a gas form, then you can filter it. And I don't think that's probably happening when you just burn it to heat water or what have you. So.
How willing is the Forest Service to have us burning a lot of the wood, cutting it out of there?
Well, we are dependent upon the Forest Service for any firewood that we do cut.
If you were to double or triple the amount that you're taking?
Well, it depends on what Copper Creek is doing. Right now we have a permit for 100 cords a year, and how much we burn is anywhere from zero up to 125, I think is the highest I've heard of, that we burn in 1 year for heating. So, but it gets less every year with efficiencies. If we were down to 50 cords a year at some kind of average, then we could double it and still be within it with the Forest Service permits that's for. But that there's a lot of potential for thinning in this valley. The valley's pretty overgrown and it's expensive to thin. So to the degree that Holden's willing to do that thinning for the firewood we get out of it, I think there would be a willingness on the part of the Forest Service to increase that allotment. Very labor intensive, but there's a lot of wood out there.
So then how many miles per cord do we get from?
The guy, my friend, he uses pellets, and it's a pound per mile on his truck. And it's pretty cheap, so it's pretty good use there.
We were looking into methane. Seems like we have a pretty good big source.
Methane from the sewer system?
Yeah.
Bob, do you know anything about that? Can you get methane off of a sewer system like ours?
Not enough to be worthwhile. But are we not to like burn a candle?
So would you have to design the whole system from scratch?
No candles, wow.
Or we put in a whole different sewer system that was somehow cooking the sewage that.
Hey, you have to get an anaerobic digestion.
Yeah. I don't know if these big pig farms will use some of the, like, normally goes into a lagoon and they produce enough methane to power up all their farm needs.
So we can raise pigs and butcher them and produce methane gas.
Where's terrible?
You might want to give people an opportunity to leave since it is night there. Those are wise things.
It is 9:30. The storm's been going for an hour, so if anyone would like to leave now, feel free to do that. You won't be insulting anyone.
Well,
snack bar's open for 15 more minutes.
15 more minutes of snack bar, half an hour until the lights go out. So.
Yeah, remember your flashlight, everybody. Half an hour to the big power outage.
Whatever preparation you need for that.
Find a place to watch the stars.
So we've talked about sort of the domestic uses in the building and the vehicles. Are there, I mean, are we missing any other demands on power and energy that have to be considered, or is that really pretty much it, the transportation?
Well, there's lots of little small equipment needs, like chainsaws and heavy equipment and those kind of things.
And of course, one of the things that, that Holden relies upon but really has no control over is the way that things are brought to Lucerne, whether they be people or the goods that are brought. So at this point, I assume those are all petroleum-powered
boats. And charges more.
Yeah, with a
surcharge.
Yeah.
Well, we can get our wood-powered paddle boat on the lake.
Yeah. Did you know Washington State Ferries is going to be using biodiesel mixes in their ferries? So that's at least they were telling
us. What ratio are they going to use?
I think it's 5% start, but hey, that's a start. So.
Yeah.
I heard that they already were, but they cut it off because there were problems with filters.
Well, they said they're still having the plan. They had this biodiesel conference in Fremont, like about a few months back, and they said that they were going to continue that, but we'll see. So that's potential, maybe even on the boat there. It told, you know, probably has a little bit of sway with the folks there on the boat, so you could persuade them maybe.
Well, if it really comes out to be at the same price,
it's awful close.
I don't know why they wouldn't. It's
diesel goes to $4 a gallon, then biodiesel can probably outbeat that.
Well, they're $3 a gallon now. That's what it costs in Fremont. And it's $3 a gallon regular diesel, pretty close.
Public diesel,
so
yeah.
Price wise, it's a toss up.
But the bulk issue is still the problem.
And also, if Seattle has will be online within a month, a 1 million gallon biodiesel refinery in downtown Seattle. So.
Well, if the price is the same and everyone wanted biodiesel, wouldn't that price go up?
You'd imagine it would. And that's what I'm kind of, that's why I think gasification, I keep thinking about that because of the demand supply issue. Mm-hmm. Because you potentially wouldn't see like a rush on pine cones. I don't think so. Whereas the biodiesel, you know, like the number of folks from last year to this year's Fremont biodiesel forum, it was like 5 times the number of people. I think it has to do with disillusioned folks after the election that decided to want to do something practical, but it was just a huge leap. And the number of biodiesel cars in Seattle has grown. But again, like I said, the refining is going to grow, and also more farmers will get online in this state because most of the farmers aren't here. They're in Iowa and Ohio and the Midwest, so you don't see many of the biodiesel movement yet hitting this side, that's the farm side, but that'll happen too.
What's the net gain from the grown source? Because the reason it's so cheap is because you get the subsidies on it.
Yeah.
So net energy has been negative.
Well, in a sense, we subsidize regular diesel and don't even know it. We don't pay the real price of it, so I don't know. Makes it even.
You've got to figure out net energy from corn sources because it's been negative.
Ben, did you want?
Yeah, this was going to be kind of a brainstorming session, and I'm just throwing this out as to grab and anybody can run with it. But one of the other technologies that is getting improved very much is solar energy panels. Okay, and it's a system here, say in application here in Holden Village, we want to have a bigger fire periphery. And if we had this solar panel sitting in there at the north end of this fire periphery that got, we could, you know, we wouldn't be so intrusive into the whole area. Of course, we'd still be in the Forest Service land and stuff like this, but it'd be an idea that it might be worthwhile looking into. Particularly if we don't have as much electricity in the fall, and we still got you know, good sunshine.
Mm-hmm. What day does the sun go over the mountains? Just out of curiosity, that's when you finally see the sun.
How high up
do
you
want to
climb?
Yeah.
It kind of skips over the mountains, and there's not a date like there is in it.
Right.
It's about mid-November.
Mid-November? Mid-February.
Yeah.
Well, not gone, but
I mean,
substantially reduced.
Reduced, that you don't, okay. Well, I'm just,
really,
as I said, I'm just throwing it out.
Always reduced here compared to other places, you know, because we're in the valley. We have shorter days here, in general.
But the panel wouldn't have to be down so bad.
Yeah, no.
But in the summertime,
the other issue is cloud cover.
Yeah.
So that your optimum window for solar panels is really just the summer months. I mean, even if you have sunshine, sun not behind the mountains, you don't necessarily have cloud.
We had solar panels in the summer. If the hydro capacity is reduced in the summer, it would be helpful. And we could consider some electric vehicles that would be powered with solar.
And unfortunately, charges. The price of panels has gone up, not down. For years, it was going down 5% a year, and then they started speculating in the last few years and treating it as a commodity, but buying the entire supply, holding onto it, what have you. So you've seen the price starting to go up a little bit, but it doesn't look like the price is going to go down anytime soon right now.
But the state of the art in solar panels has changed radically in terms of the amount of actual direct sunlight that's required.
Mm-hmm.
And there's new technology that's just hit the availability level that's come online in the last 2 years.
Well, if you were looking at just heating water, you wouldn't need to generate electricity. You could do that directly with the sun. And that would be much lower technology, presumably cheaper.
Like those panels down at the A-frame, that's a grand's worth of panels. I don't mean as far as the money issue, it's probably not looking like there's going to be the right curve yet, you know. I think we've got to wait some time for the price to go down, production price. It's just still too expensive. Again, like those two panels, they have 25-year guarantee. I think solar is great for standalone, low maintenance, where you don't, but as far as the high, doesn't look like it would be cost effective for a village like this, especially. I mean,
we're probably looking in the future a fair distance before we don't have hydropower in the summer. I mean, even this year with an extreme low snowpack, we're fine all summer. Right now we're generating 250 kilowatts, which is still a lot, even though there's not more than that like there normally is. So is this year an anomaly? Well, probably is to some degree, even though we might eventually get to this point every year. So there's a lot of things that can be developed, and a lot of things we can only dream about now, which may be a possibility. Is there any other systems? We've talked about solar and biodiesel. Does anyone know anything about fuel cells or microturbines or anything a little more out there as far as technology goes?
There's a question before you go on. I mentioned geothermal heat. Now, what is the temperature of the water in the mine? Anybody know?
I've got the data in my briefcase. I could probably dig it out. It's pretty cold.
It is.
Yeah.
And yet mining generally uses the ventilation fans to cool things. I'm just remembering historically that it's warm down there.
Yeah, but the ground, but the water is.
It's probably
percolating through the ground. Again.
Yeah, it's groundwater temperature. It's probably around 42 or 44.
I have a question about fuel cells. It's a storage method and not a generation method. So, only in very large scale could you generate at a time when you had excess water, you could store it. But that would be a pretty serious chunk in, you know, what was it called?
But we talked about that question earlier today. Is that a possible long-term storage of electricity
storage,
so that you could really change your seasonal use?
Right. And in essence, that's what the mining company would be doing for us.
Right.
But that's sort of cheating.
a lot of talk in our newspapers lately about wind and harnessing the wind for energy. I don't know what we have here, if that's ever been measured, checked out, or whatever for the wind farms.
Well, it's not windy here in the winter, very rarely. And the wind is not very consistent in the summer. We do have some windy days. We generally have a down valley wind most evenings. It's not real strong, so if anyone here has more knowledge than I do about what kind of winds are required, a wind turbine could be just one more thing to add to the pot, that when it does blow, you get something from it.
Yeah, ultimately, all these systems have to be gauged by the cost per kilowatt.
Exactly.
And some of these otherwise attractive, interesting technologies at this point in time just don't compete with, certainly with hydropower, which is still a lot less, least cost per kilowatt. But the gas-fired microturbine has some promise, but we'll ultimately have to wait on getting the cost down on the total system. Right now, there are in service 7 gasifier-powered 15 kW turbines. I'm sorry, these are not turbines, they're gas engines. But the gas turbine equivalent is being scaled up from 15 to 35 kW and all the way 50 kW, but then it gets you into an area where you need enough gas that a downdraft gasifier doesn't give you enough fuel, so then you have to go to a fluidized bed gasifier, which then adds money, and then you need a front-end automated wood chipper, dryer, or pelletizer to feed it. So, in round numbers, you end up with a $200,000 today 15 kW generator that would buy you a slug of diesel generator. So, it isn't surprising that the mining company will probably end up with a diesel generator on a skid, because that's the real world, that's the most practical way to generate off-grid power. The attraction of the gasifier turbine combination is that you're not only generating electrical power, but you also can capture the heat. So the total system efficiency goes way up. So the actual power output of the generator isn't the ultimate measure of the energy you've got to work with, because there's a source of heat for hot water that has its equivalent in the kilowatt demand for electrical power.
Exactly.
It's worth, I think, tracking for the village to see what comes of these Forest Service installations. They're all in the west, of course. And there's 7 of them. There actually were 8, and one of them is being, as we speak, being shipped from Arrowhead, Lake Arrowhead, where they didn't really have satisfactory utilization, and it's being placed on an Indian reservation in Nevada, where it will be used, where the fuel will be agricultural waste. The advantage of a gasifier is that you don't have to burn wood chips. Any biomass that can be reduced in size and fed through the system will give you enough BTUs to do the job. But this project on the Washoe Tribe lands outside of Reno will be used not to generate electrical power, but to generate heat to raise fish. They're going to start a tilapia farm. This will be the second attempt. Tilapia need 57 degree water. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd probably need more than that to get.
That's a minimum, yes.
Yeah, it's a minimum temperature. Peak production in tilapia is about 65 degrees, so.
It's about 13 minutes till lights out.
We don't have a flashlight.